Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Shell's 3 Cents, and I am Michelle Murray, your host. If you're in Los Angeles, I don't even have to tell you that Thomas Fire is still burning. Over the weekend, this fire reemerged with a vengeance, and it pushed right on into Santa Barbara County, and it destroyed even more homes. Firefighters are telling us the dead brush and those Santa Ana winds seem to be the culprit at turning this fire into a huge monster that they're really having a tough time trying to control. So stay safe, Los Angelinos, and please evacuate if you have to. Your life is precious, and it cannot be replaced. Things can always be replaced, but your life can't. Also in this morning's news, Ed Lee, the first Asian mayor of San Francisco, has died. He was 65. My condolences go out to his family and loved ones. Now, I don't have to tell you about that 405 freeway. It's a mess. It's always a mess. And it seems like it'll never stop being a mess. Well, it's been closed in both directions lately for the fires. Then it reopened. Then it closed again early this morning after a car struck an LAPD vehicle and severely injured an officer. Well, it seems all of that's finally been cleared up now, and you can access the freeway again. And I don't know about you guys, but if I had to travel the 405, I'd start trying to come up with an alternate route. It's a mess over there. Be careful. Now, in other news, America's veterans wonder if standard of care is up to par in VA facilities. You know, it's whispered, it's talked about out loud, but is it up to par? As the nation seeks to implement health care reform in a way that provides the best care and the best value to Americans, there's some thought that the VA could also use some overhaul and reform. That's what we're going to talk about today. So preventive care, good coordination, and integration are sadly, more often than we think possible, out of the reach of veterans that use the Veterans Affairs healthcare system. It's just a fact. Today I have three veterans that will share their stories with you. Callie Walker, Rebecca Hall, and Rachel Keith. They all have stories of not just ineptitude, failure to diagnose, and failure to treat, but they have stories that could ultimately cost them their lives if something doesn't happen soon. So, ladies, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let me just make sure, did I get all three ladies in the queue there?
Thank you, Michelle. Yes,
super,
we're all here.
Super. Super. You know, it makes me sad as a veterans advocate, as somebody that works frequently with veterans on all sorts of issues, whether it's benefits or medical or whatever the issue is, you know, I see this stuff. I've even experienced a few things myself, so I'm constantly shedding light on it. But it seems here lately there's just been a few things that are almost what I term outrageous. If you listen to my show earlier this week, and even last week, I talked about my own issue with a particular VA up in Oregon that not only was giving me grief, but my opinion as a patient, it came across as there's some sort of cover-up. So in trying to resolve all of that, I continue to hear from veterans, including these three ladies, about atrocities. In my book, there are atrocities. When you're talking about something that impacts somebody to the point of it could mean their death, that is an atrocity. It's not an inconvenience. It's not, you know, bureaucracy. It is an atrocity. So, Callie, I'd like to start with your story. Tell us a little bit about your situation and what kind of happened.
Well, it all kind of started in the process of seeing my normal psychiatrist. I'm 100% for PTSD alone at this point. And one of her interns was coming through the office and had just noticed, she said, you know, I think your throat is pretty swollen. Have you ever been checked for your thyroid? Which, of course, hadn't occurred to me at that point. But they referred me to my primary care physician to have that checked. The first standard levels came back normal, but because of the swelling, they went ahead and sent me to ultrasound. This was back in September-August timeframe. That result came back, and it had, at the very bottom, potentially malignant. But
so did they contact you right away? Did they do some follow-up?
absolutely not. They didn't even contact me at all. Like I said, I've been going through this process since almost June with the thyroid issue. And I finally was like, well, if they're not going to help me, if they're not going to continue to progress my care to a specialist, you know, let me see if I can't get my records and maybe go to a private physician. And that's when I saw it yesterday, matter of fact. That was the first time that I saw the possibly malignant. And I was very upset. I was very pissed off because until this point, nobody has ever said that to me.
Of course, understandably so. Rebecca, what about you? What was your experience with a VA medical center that has you kind of upset today?
Back in 2016 of last year, I had an annual pap done because I am high risk for cervical cancer because I have had abnormal paps in the past. I left the country. I was living in Thailand when the results came back. So never really looked into it. This August, I started having severe issues. I normally have a very easy, light flow period. And then starting in August and September, all through August and September, I had three periods a month and was bleeding so heavily I was blacking out at work. So I looked into my medical records on MyHealthVet online, and I saw that I had an abnormal pap. So I called them, and I spoke with the nurse, and they told me, and I told them all my symptoms, and they said, that is indicative of cervical cancer. You need to get seen immediately. So I called the VA, scheduled an appointment with a doctor, they said. Go to the appointment, and she introduced herself as a doctor, but she told me that she couldn't examine me because she was not qualified to do a pap. So I was extremely frustrated, and she told me that it was going to take 3 months to get seen by a gynecologist. So I started panicking, didn't know what to do, started calling everyone I knew. I called an oncology nurse, a friend of mine, and she said the exact same thing, you need to get seen immediately because cervical cancer can go from being able to cure easily to incurable. And I wasn't getting any leeway with the VA, so I knew that Texas Healthcare, I was told that the VA here in Fort Worth was awesome. And also I had a very good actual, Rachel Keith, who's going to be on next. She has an apartment on her property that she's going to let me stay on because I couldn't work. I had no, you know, I couldn't afford rent. So she offered me to move in with her. And so I moved to Texas specifically for healthcare and to get taken care of. The VA in Fort Worth, they told me that I couldn't even register unless I had all of my DD-214 original documentation and all my military medical records, which is not accurate. They actually, I had to speak with several other people to actually get checked. Yeah. Sorry, I'm kind of rambling. But it's been over 2 months. I still have not received any information about what I'm going through. I have called everyone possible, and I've also found out that they are misrepresenting my information on my medical records, taking pain scales, lowering them, lowering symptoms to appear normal, reporting that I went in to be seen for a painful period. So all the information that they put in my medical records is inaccurate, and it's causing extreme difficulty to get referrals. There is not even a gynecologist on staff at the Fort Worth Women's Clinic. So right now I still have no idea what's going on with my health, and I cannot get a single doctor to examine me and help me.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we're going to come back to you in just a moment. Rachel,
okay.
If Rachel could tell us her story just a little bit.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hi, great. How are you today? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to hear a little bit about your story. What has been your experience? What problem are you having with your VA?
Well, my problems in the VA actually these are my story is about 3, 4, 5 years old, because I was actually, after 17 years of service, medically retired. But my concern is that the problems I was having with the VA back then is exactly the same problems Rebecca is going through now. So to me, that is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yes. So the main – oh, go ahead.
Was your problem ever rectified? Did you personally get some sort of resolution?
It was resolved, but I had to go through hell and back to get, you know, what I needed done and the treatment that I needed. I had to contact our Senator Kay Granger here. Her office is actually in the city where I'm from. I had to go meet with her office 3 times. And my case was flagged at the Pentagon level. I was one of 11 cases because this process was taking so long. And then magically, after I got in touch with my congressman or congresswoman, then all of a sudden it was resolved. However, I do a lot of veteran advocacy work, and I just heard another horror story about our local VA. There was a gentleman that was seeking treatment, mental health treatment for his PTSD. And because they didn't like his, he didn't want group therapy, he wanted individual. And because he wasn't cooperating, they sent him to the building where they treat the female military MST victims. So they, rather than deal with him in the main buildings, because, you know, he rubbed them the wrong way, they went ahead and had him treated by this counselor that was treating, you know, the women with PTSD. And
that sounds a bit like retribution.
Exactly. As I said, exactly. It's retribution. That's exactly what it is. You know, you hear horror stories about how, you know, if they don't, if you cause any sort of uproar or disagreement, or if you voice your concerns, there is a, I guess you would call it a blacklist. They put your name on it, and you know, if they find you threatening enough, they will not let you get care at that treatment facility.
Oh, absolutely.
So he was worried about, that happening, but rather than barring him from the Dallas VA, they just went ahead and put him in this outbuilding with these women who were MST survivors.
And he
just felt,
you know, that's
horrible.
I can only imagine. It's almost like they re-victimized him again is what happened. You know, it's kind of how I felt
exactly.
My experience with the Roseburg VA. You know, as far they even went so far as to throw my blood away. I can't get an answer there. Then they locked me out of my records, marking them all kinds of, you know, they're sensitive, they're this, they're that. And I really felt like it was retribution because I spoke up about an issue.
Yes.
Callie, you know, do you and Rebecca, do you ladies fear retribution? Or Rachel, even at this point, do you fear retribution for speaking up or trying to make things better?
That's one of the benefits, I think, now, you know, because this was 3, 4, and 5 years ago, because it was like a 3-year experience. I'm retired now. I have my retiree benefits, so I don't have to go to the VA. But what is heartbreaking is that, you know, like I was saying, I do a lot of veteran advocacy, visiting the patients at the VA hospital, and I have had to, you know, and I live, you know, west outside of the city, I drove over an hour to get to the VA hospital to help this veteran who was having seizures. They wanted to release him from the hospital. He had been admitted, and they wanted to release him, but I went down there, and I had to go find a director, explain what was going on, and luckily, you know, they were able to rectify that situation and keep him in the hospital until he was stable. But I was just shocked that, I mean, what if I didn't know enough about the system to help this guy? Where would he have, You know what I mean? Where would he? What could have happened? He could have had a seizure while he was driving, you know, or worse. Like, yeah, it's a pretty sad situation, and it's really disheartening that it doesn't seem to be improving.
Yeah, I agree with you. Callie, what about you? Do you fear retribution for speaking out from your facility?
I'm not going to say that I fear it. At this point, it would be welcome because you're not going to shut me up. So if you want to play games and you want to play retribution, well, my point and my stance is bring it on because I'll just go until I get a resolution.
I love that.
Yeah, that's pretty
you.
Much where I stand on it, too. Because, you know, ladies, at the end of the day, it's important for every veteran who's been aggrieved to tell their story because, you know what, we're young enough, and despite whatever health issues we have, we are still able to run from floor to floor, place to place, and call everybody and gather information. But I always say, what about that paraplegic vet? What about that 90-year-old vet suffering from Alzheimer's?
Right.
You know, there are so many other circumstances in which people will have no voice. So it's very important that we all tell our stories and that we put eyes on it. You know, this whole entire week I've been quoting someone who said, predators thrive in darkness. And it's true. Predators do thrive in darkness. All kind of these flashlights, if you will, or candles or chem lights that shine light on this and don't allow it. You know, I have somebody in the chat that's asking me, do you think the problem is with the VA or is it more with the CHOICE program? I'd like to hear each of you. Callie, if you want to chime
well,
in
Michelle,
on that.
Well, Michelle, I wanted to say something because
okay,
you
ahead.
And I have a mutual friend that just recently joined the Navy. He's a young man, maybe about 17, or actually I think he's 18 now,
mm-hmm.
that just recently mm-hmm. joined the military, and I have a daughter who's in the process of potentially joining the Air Force. I'm not going to let these kids that I've raised that are in my life
right.
that have now gone on and made me proud by joining the military suffer for bullshit that we've been dealing with. You know, our Vietnam veterans, when they came home, they came home to nothing, and they fought very hard to get where we are now. So it's kind of like passing the baton. Our Vietnam veterans
mm-hmm.
had to fight like hell, and now we're going to have to fight like hell. But we're going to fight so that the next generation doesn't have to.
Exactly. That's absolutely where I stand on that. Absolutely where I stand on that. And I'm sure Rebecca and Rachel feel the exact same way. That's ridiculous. But so to go back to what this person wrote in the chat, do you think the problem is with the VA or is it more with the CHOICE program? What do you ladies think about that?
I want to say it's both because in my circumstance, my physician had made a consult to get a biopsy done, but TriWest was taking so long to get the appointment, we didn't understand why. So I went to patient advocacy, and we looked into the system to where the VA had not sent the images that the physician that I was being referred to needed. So we had to fix that. So I think there might be a gap in communication between all of those processes.
Mm-hmm. I've even spoke with several VA employees that say the CHOICE program is a joke. It takes weeks. They take up to 3 weeks to get any kind of paperwork done, which is on the VA side. And then the clinics that they connect you with, they are horrible. It took me, the first time I used the CHOICE program, it took me, I believe, a month. It was like 3 weeks to a month to actually have the paperwork transferred to the CHOICE program. And I had to contact the CHOICE program. And they gave me a clinic that was the closest to me. I called them every day for a week. And this clinic went directly, it would ring and then go directly to voicemail. I was never able to speak with one person. I left a voicemail every single day and called multiple times throughout the day. Never got through to them. So I called the CHOICE program, and they connected me with a different doctor. It took me over 3 weeks to get seen and then another 3 weeks to get the ultrasound and speak with a surgeon. By the time I actually met with the surgeon that was supposed to do the surgery, I sat in his office, and he said to me, I'm sorry, there's really nothing we can do for you because the VA just canceled your choice privileges. And I asked him why, and he said he didn't know. I would have to contact. So I contacted the choice program. They called the VA for every day for almost a week, and they could not get an answer. So I was going to have to go back to the VA and start the entire process all over again while I was in extreme pain and needing help.
And you bring up an interesting point because there is some overhaul that's going on with the choice program. But what they're doing, they're not, instead of discussing it with the veterans or letting certain, you know, the veteran have a heads up, it's exactly the situation you just described. All of a sudden, the veteran goes to the doctor or they're expecting a referral, only to find out it's not there. And then they have to run around, call around. And in most cases, they're calling and they're getting voicemails. They're not getting any answers. They have to get dressed, go to a facility, only to find out, for whatever reason, they're no longer in the choice program. But part of that has to do with the fact that they are planning to overhaul the program. There's not a whole lot of word on the street about what's going to happen. There is going to be some kind of going back to the fee-based that we used to have. And also just taking some of that money and putting that money back into local VAs. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. If they took the money they were spending on choice and put it back into your local VA, do you think your quality of care would improve, ladies?
No, absolutely not. The VA that I currently am assigned to, the West Texas VA, has a 1-star rating. I mean, honestly, if that was a private facility, it would have been closed by now for those ratings.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
This isn't just a one
hospital or one clinic issue. This is statewide. I do a lot of veteran advocacy as well, and I have around 5,000 followers on my Facebook, and they constantly are reaching out to me, asking me for help, asking me what's going on with my choice and all the other VA issues I have. And I've done absolutely everything I can to follow, you know, guidelines and to not break rules and go above and, you know, following the whole chain of command type thing. And that's where we get in trouble, because I actually contacted a patient advocate, and I had a patient advocate message me and tell me, you need to stop posting on Facebook. You need to stop, you know, I believe she said, don't bite the hand that fed you or something along those words. Mm-hmm. That's coming from a patient advocate. And if we can't go to them, then who can we go to?
Who can you turn to? That's absolutely right. I agree with that. And that's kind of been my frustration as well. If you can't report to the people you're supposed to be able to report to, then what do you do? And again, you know, we are still mobile enough and agile of mind enough that we can run around and find alternate sources. But I really worry about those that are too infirm to do so, or those that are 17,
exactly,
18, or 19 years old, you know, maybe got hit with an IED and don't know what to do. So
yep.
I think that's a travesty. You know, USA Today recently released an investigative report. And within that report, it cites the fact, and I underscore, it's a fact. It's not anyone's opinion. It's a fact that VA facilities frequently hire problem doctors and nurses, people who have been fired from, you know, other healthcare facilities, people who have been accused of negligence in other facilities, people who have been accused of mistreatment in other facilities, but the VA brings them on board. Do you think this has anything to do with any of the problems you ladies have seen in your local VA facilities? Chime in. I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Basically, we have the messaging system where you can telephone the nurse or you can leave a message for your doctor and all that stuff. I've used that on several occasions here locally for myself, and they never get returned. I've actually had to make appointments just to leave a message for my physician. Mm-hmm. So, it's my belief that it's the nurse. It's the nurse, you know. I'm active in my health care, and I want answers to my stuff, and, you know, that's a pain in the ass for her. So she ignores it.
And sometimes when you call in, when you call in, they will just let the phone ring, go to voicemail, and then it will just cut you off. Like, it won't even give you an opportunity to leave a message. So it's like the cycle of, you know, trying to get a hold of the physician or the nurse or, you know, questions about your treatment, and, you know, it's impossible to get a call back sometimes.
That's horrible, but I've experienced it, so I know for sure, definitely, you know, it happens. definitely happens, without a doubt, it happens. I've got somebody that's typing to me on the chat, and they're saying that I also read a report that reveals VA facilities protect inept healthcare professionals in two ways. First, by hiring them, and second, by not reporting complaints about them to state licensing boards. What do you ladies think about that? I agree with that. What do you ladies think
yes.
about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a recent story about a VA hospital hiring a doctor who had multiple complaints on him, had patients die under his care, and his license was revoked, but the VA had hired him and was letting him operate on our veterans. And now we have veterans that, you know, from these surgeries, their issues are compounded now because of this doctor's, you know, his lack of skill, and the VA didn't do anything to, you know, to clear him for treating the vets. I don't know what their policy is, you know, what they do to, you know, well, I don't know what their vetting process is, but that needs to be improved for sure.
No, that definitely needs to be improved. I need to do some more research. If you just look at USA jobs, basically it seems like if they went to medical school, they're good. If they have a license that has not yet expired or been revoked, even if it's under review, they're still good, and they get
right.
hired. But I'd actually like to meet somebody, and not, you know, that's a horrible thing, because the VA is supposed to help our veterans, not put them in harm's way. You know, at the end of the day, my personal thought is the VA should absolutely be embarrassed for the mistreatment of, you know, our nation's veterans. At the end of the day, they should be embarrassed over that. So.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, ladies, what would you like to see happen within the walls of your facility or within the walls of the VA overall? Let's just kind of go round robin. We'll start with Rebecca, then hit Rachel, then Callie.
That could be in a novel.
Uh-huh, I agree.
Oh, my goodness. I've never met a group of employees that, or medical professionals that, you know, went to school for years and years to help people. That's what they, you know, that's their profession, is to help people. They swore to do no harm. Yet I have found numerous other people that have had the same thing, lying on, you know, falsifying information on our medical records for petty reasons, to save a couple dollars. I still don't understand why. They need to be held accountable for this. And it seems that our government, and the VA especially, is defending these people that are in the wrong, clearly in the wrong. It does. It breaks my heart that I had another veteran reach out to me. And they basically, while he was going into surgery, he was blown up and he hit by an IED and almost lost both of his legs. And he has been fighting to keep both of his legs. And all they have been doing is trying to pressure him in to amputating his legs. So he was in surgery, and they brought him in the forms and tried to have him sign it under, and like, while he was already medicated. They tried to trick him into signing it so they could take his legs. And I don't know how to fix corruption at that level. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. It's really, you know, I'm sitting here, and it's been 2 months.
And I agree with you. And,
and I'm just waiting, and, you know, I'm waiting here knowing that there's something wrong and I could die and there's nothing I can do.
And
so
I think there's a lot of others that are feeling that way. What about you, Rachel? Are you near the phone? Can you tell us what would you like to see happen?
What would I like to see happen?
Yeah, what change would you make if you could snap your fingers and have something change within the walls of the VA?
Well, if I had the answer, I would be out there implementing it for sure. But
I think we all would.
I do know that, I mean, as far as what we can do, what I can do, just like your other guest said, they were talking about speaking out. I'm sorry, I forget her name. She was talking about speaking out. Yes. I also believe that we veterans and those that support the military community, we need to be building relationships with one another. And this includes social media. You know, there's some, you know, people talk bad about social media, but honestly, it's a great way to unite people and get information out there. And also, I think we need to utilize our social media to create a movement. People need to hear our stories. We can share our stories on these platforms, and that will just get more and more people behind us and hopefully make a change that way.
I like that
and,
idea.
And
a
honestly,
lot. I think we're gonna have to do that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, and if I would add one more thing, I really think mm-hmm. that unless it is if it's mental health care, I think the VA, maybe they should just be handling the mental health care and then outsource everything else. I think there's got to be a solution somewhere in the middle where, you know, whether it's a mix between the, you know, privatized health care versus the government, you know, the VA health care. They have to come up with a better program. The choice program isn't working. And again, it comes down to speaking out and building those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree. Absolutely. Callie, what would you like to see happen within the walls of your facility?
There's a couple of things. Well, first of all, I myself, like, as I said earlier, I have 100% just for PTSD alone. I wanted to go through schooling to become a mental health professional. But the VA won't assist in that because I've already used my VA benefit, my educational benefits. But if the problem we have is that we're not being treated by other veterans, we're being treated by people who have no concept or understanding of what it means to be a veteran. They can't comprehend the issues that we deal with. But veterans ourselves, we do. So why not let those people who do want to become involved in the VA system in a health care manner do so? I mean, I already work in veteran advocacy, too. We do outreach constantly. Why not educate somebody who's already passionate about these issues? And they will be better quality physicians, better quality mental health professionals, better quality nurses.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my biggest change that I think that I would like to see within the VA.
Absolutely. I agree. You ladies have wonderful suggestions. So big VA, if you're listening, you know, the veterans on my show today, they're saying what all the other veterans across America are saying. They want accountability. They want transparency. They want corruption to fall by the wayside. You know, they just want the right thing done. at the end of the day. So hopefully we'll continue to have these conversations. We'll continue to shed light. We will not let the predators hide in the darkness. And ladies, I wish each and every one of you Godspeed as you continue your fight. Please keep me updated and let me know how things are going. I will be as much of a help as I can. Sitting on our laurels and being quiet, that is not an option. We have to be very, very proactive, and we have to help each other. So if you're a veteran that's listening, you know, I encourage you, reach out a helping hand to your fellow vet. You know, be that change you want to see. We have to, as Rebecca alluded, we need to stick together. We need to build relationships just like we did in the military, one team, one fight kind of thing. So, ladies, we're at the end of our show. So I want to tell you thank you. I appreciate you coming in, and I will look forward to updates and hearing what's going on with your own case within the VA wall.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, ladies. Thank you for being brave enough to tell your story. It takes courage to come forward and tell your story. Too many people are hiding. You know, I gave examples the other day. There's people up in Oregon that are literally in hiding. People even told me they're afraid somebody's going to kill them. And we cannot allow fear to cripple us. We have to tell our story.
No.
This is the only way. A broken system will be the only way. So, ladies, you have a great day. And to the rest of my listeners, we're going to move into a Writers Guild of America podcast. So if you're interested in writing, getting your work seen, listen to this. Have a great day.
The next part of our show is...
Welcome back to Third and Fairfax. I'm Steve Troutman, and this is episode 54 of the Writers Guild podcast. We have a very special podcast this week, not your standard writer interview, although writers are discussing things, but we have the negotiating committee discussing and explaining what's been going on with them in our negotiations with the AMPTP. So before we get to that, I do want to clear a couple things up or just make a couple things clear, because there's some inside baseball being talked and some acronyms and terms that listeners may not be familiar with. One of those you will hear about the board and council, and that refers to the governing bodies of the Writers Guild of America West and the Writers Guild of America East. The board of directors is the Writers Guild of America West's governing body, and that consists of 16 elected members and 3 officers, president, vice president, and secretary treasurer. The council is the governing body of the Writers Guild of America East. It has 19 members, plus elected members, plus their 3 officers as well. So that's board and council. You might hear that a couple times, or you will hear that. And then there's O and E, and O and E stands for options and exclusivity. And what that is the ability of networks and production companies to hold writers who have been contracted to write on shows exclusively for certain periods of time. With shorter seasons becoming more prevalent, this can hurt a writer's ability to make a living or make a living wage when they're unable to take other writing jobs in first position. So that's O and E, options and exclusivity. The other thing you'll hear discussed a few times is script parity or script fee parity. And that deals with bringing the script fees for cable and streaming more in line with the script fees, what writers are paid for scripts on network. So kind of getting a parity between cable and streaming and network. And that should about do it. The other thing I want to mention before we get started is kind of give you a little idea of who is speaking and who is speaking when, to try to put a name to the face. The members do introduce themselves, but just so you know, you'll hear Kate Erickson first. She's kind of facilitating this whole thing. And then they will introduce themselves. And then off the bat, Chris Kaiser will kind of give a little perspective on what's going on. And then Chip Johannesson jumps in, and then you'll hear Billy Ray. So Chris Kaiser goes first, then you'll hear a little bit from Chip Johannesson, and then Billy Ray. And that should about do it. I hope that helps. And Kate, take it away.
Great. So we'll start today with a few introductions. I'm Kate Erickson. I am a WGA East member on the negotiating committee. It's my first year on the negotiating committee. I've been learning a lot. I'm joined today by our three co-chairs for the negotiating committee. I'll let them introduce themselves. We'll start with Billy Ray.
I'm Billy Ray.
Chip Johannesson.
And Chris Kaiser.
Excellent. So we'll jump right in, guys, because I think everyone is really interested to hear about these negotiations. I think there's a lot of confusion out there right now, specifically as we go into the strike authorization vote, and there's a bit of confusion between what a strike, the difference between a strike authorization vote and going on strike. So if we could start with kind of separating those two terms and understanding that completely, I think that'd be great.
Yeah, Kate, is it okay if I just sort of put it all in perspective? So
we
began negotiations with 2 weeks of scheduled negotiations.
And
we'll talk more about the way they concluded, because I think members have heard about that. We did that in anticipation of the fact that our contract expires on May 1, and we work everything backwards from May 1. At the end of those 2 weeks, the two sides were at a kind of mini impasse. And at that point, it was necessary for us to take what would be the next step for the Writers Guild, East and West, in this process, which is to prepare for the possibility that if the deal that's on the table as it was at the end of those 2 weeks were still on the table on the eve of our contract being up, that we need to be prepared to do what was necessary. That means we needed to be prepared to strike if necessary. If necessary is, I think, the important thing to say. To do that, there's a process that's put in place, and it begins with the fact that the membership needs to, well, let me put it, I'll step back. First, we had to go to both the guild, the board, and council. The negotiating committee had to make a decision to go to the board and council and request what is called a strike authorization vote. The negotiating committee decided that unanimously. The board and council, the East and West, decided unanimously to recommend a strike authorization vote. What that means is we go back to our members and we say to them, we would like you to give us the authority, should it be necessary, to call a strike. Not the same thing as deciding that we're going to be calling a strike. It's just the authority that's necessary for us to do that at the moment when push comes to shove. And the arguments about why the membership should do that or not, we can talk about here. It's a long process, by the way. It doesn't just happen. The ballots will be sent out, but there will also be membership meetings. Conversations will be had. The members will be given every opportunity to ask all the questions they need about where the negotiations stand, what our philosophy is going forward, what we hope to gain, what the risks are, all of that. The important thing, though, is that if we were not to ask for a strike authorization vote and then get an authorization by our members, we would not be in the position of calling a strike should that be necessary. And in the long run, as we've said from the very beginning, although none of us want a strike, the single piece of leverage that we have, the biggest piece of leverage that's gotten us everything up to this point in our guild, our pension and health and our residuals and our jurisdiction over new media, is either the threat of or the actual practice of a strike. So it is the leverage we have.
I mean, even the formation of this guild itself happened under a, they were trying to do a contract for, 2 years, something like that, and it was only the real threat of a strike, and that went down to the wire that allowed the formation of the guild in the first place. And so just to follow up a little on that thing, this is all Article 9 of our Constitution, if people want to look at it, about all these procedures, but...
Which is online, right? People can look at it.
Which is online, but you probably got a sense that there are a bunch of steps that are mandated, and they take a certain amount of time. And so, like Chris said, just to get that ball rolling in the event that it becomes necessary, we had to start that. That also means that it was not a surprise to the AMPTP when they put a deal on the table that they knew was unacceptable to us, that we would, our next piece of business would be to start the strike authorization vote happening.
It's not done to create anxiety among the membership, although we are aware that it does create anxiety among the membership. But had we not begun that process, if we reached an impasse on May 1st and then decided to start this process, it would be weeks before we could actually create the steps necessary that we could walk out.
And right. So what this does, in addition, is it creates some natural bargaining windows for us to go back to the table. I mean, has it been announced yet?
Yeah.
So it's been announced that we're going to be back in a week from
April 10th.
April 10th, and there's a natural thing. That's even before the strike vote happens.
Before any membership meetings would happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we will continue to negotiate during that week, and then hopefully all the way through to May 1st, continuing to try to reach an agreement before that contract expires.
My hope is that it takes less time than that. And I just want to clear something up, because there's been such a misinformation campaign by the AMPTP about how the talks broke down in the first place, this idea that the Writers Guild walked out of the talks. It's just an absolutely provable falsehood. We made a major, major step in the negotiations, which I thought had been going pretty well. Was it Wednesday or Tuesday of the
Wednesday.
Same week? Wednesday of the second week. We made a major step in one of the proposals that we made to them. We actually, by that point, had taken 44%